Good morning. Welcome to the January sitting. We welcome especially this morning students from Fond du Lac High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Palmyra Eagle High School. Would they stand? And welcome to you. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Fourth Good Class. And the students are invited, students from around the state are invited to come and listen to an oral argument. And if they agree to come, they're sent materials about the case. They're encouraged to have activities related to this case. Then come to the court and participate at noon, if they can stay, in a conversation about the procedures that this court uses, not the substantive issues of the case. And you are, everyone here is welcome to attend that session after our second case today. We've met you, so let me introduce the court to all of you. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robinsack. You will meet with Justice Robinsack today at noon. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser. And the far right chair, at which Justice Ziegler ordinarily sits, is vacant. Justice Ziegler will not be participating in this case. So with those introductions made, I will call our first case, 06AP3156, Edward U. Knotts versus Everett Smith Group Limited. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Knotts is Matthew O'Neill. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Associate Justices, and may it please the Court. My name is Matthew O'Neill. I represent Petitioner Edward Knotts. Mr. Knotts is in court today in the first row here with me. This case will determine whether minority shareholders in Wisconsin have any meaningful rights to assert and enforce fiduciary duties owed directly to them. In Wisconsin, at least since 1903, majority shareholders have owed a fiduciary duty directly to minority shareholders. It's a version of the Golden Rule, and it states that the majority shareholder may not place its own interests ahead of those of a minority shareholder. Since 1991, minority shareholders have also had a statutory right under the Judicial Dissolution Statute to pursue a claim based upon oppressive behavior by those in control of the corporation. Now, Mr. Knotts was a long-time minority shareholder in Albert Trostel & Sons, or ATS. His great-grandfather, in fact, founded the company 150 years ago. In 2003, the defendant, the Everett Smith Group, the owner of 89% of the ATS stock at the time, approached Mr. Knotts and tried to buy him out.
Counselor, if your client proceeds on his claim for dissolution, my understanding is that dissolution then ceases the existence of the corporation. Its assets are liquidated, and they're divided among the shareholders, correct?
That is correct. That's what would happen upon a dissolution.
Okay. And at this particular point in time, he has been subject to a cash-out merger, so he doesn't have any shares. And I understand whether he got the fair value is being litigated, which is an action separate from what we're doing. What I'm trying to understand is, if there is a dissolution and the assets are distributed, if he's no longer a shareholder, then what does he gain by the dissolution except stopping the existence of the corporation?
If, in fact, a court were to dissolve the company,
yep.
Nothing. However, the judicial dissolution action does not need to result in judicial dissolution, and in fact, the case law demonstrates it rarely does. When oppression is proven under Wisconsin statute and other similar statutes adopted in well over half the states, courts have equitable jurisdiction upon the proof of oppression to take action and impose remedies short of dissolving the company and ordering liquidation. In fact, cases recognize frequently dissolution is the last possible remedy because upon a liquidation you're often not going to get the kind of value that you could upon the sale of the company, for example. And what courts will often do is fashion remedies individual to the harm demonstrated by that minority shareholder to remedy the oppression.
Okay, well, tell me what you have in mind, because I'm not conjuring up much here on my own.
Well, what Mr. Noakes has sought as far as a remedy is a couple of things. And one was an order for an accounting of the plastics operations that are currently under the ownership of the Everett Smith Group and were at the time the case was filed, and a disgorgement of any profits in accordance with his prior ownership level of the plastics. Another was an order requiring the Everett Smith Group to provide to Mr. Noakes 5.5% ownership in those plastics operations to put him back in the position he had been prior to the oppressive conduct. Another remedy sought is compensatory damages, which would be determined by looking at the profits and performance of plastics. And Mr. Noakes is also seeking punitive damages.
Wouldn't the compensatory damages, though, weigh in when you're trying to determine, and the other compensatory damages that you talk about for an accounting, wouldn't that all weigh into whether he'd received the fair value for his shares at the cash-out merger? I mean, it seems that all of it's tied to his status as a shareholder. So what those shares are worth now and were worth because of the company's actions or inactions that he complains of, isn't that all tied up in the fair value of his shares?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor, and at the current time, it's unresolved. We are currently litigating in the federal court. ATS chose to file in federal court the fair value action under diversity jurisdiction, and it is currently in dispute whether Mr. Noakes can, in fact, as part of the fair value determination, seek to recover anything relating to the plastics operations and his allegations of misconduct relating to plastics and other allegations of misconduct. ATS has taken the position that in the valuation proceeding, only the value as of May 17, 2007, the date of the merger, can be determined, and any misconduct prior to that that's involved in this lawsuit is irrelevant for purposes of determining value. And Judge Clavert has not decided whether Mr. Noakes can or cannot.
Okay, so that is a pending question in the other litigation. Okay.
Yes, and it's our position that under HMOW, this court decided that such misconduct can, in fact, be determined and placed into issue in the determination of a fair value proceeding. ATS takes the opposite view.
Right, and that's all in the other action. Okay, thanks. That helped me a lot. Thank you.
Now, when
is Judge Clavert waiting for us in this case?
We do not know, Your Honor.
Mm-mm. We don't know.
It's there is a discovery, well, there's cross motions. We moved to compel discovery, they moved to
you're not up to
our
decision making yet.
It's been fully briefed since July and we have no decision.
Okay. No 90-day rule in the federal courts.
None that I'm aware of.
All right.
Well,
you're interrupted. Let me ask you this. I have some problems reconciling Wisconsin cases. Maybe you can help me. And I'll ask the same question of Mr. Schreiner. In Reed versus Reed, which is a Court of Appeals case of 1996, a minority shareholder in two corporations alleged in relevant part that the corporation's controlling shareholder, plaintiff's father, as it happens, had engaged in self-dealing in violation of his fiduciary duty to minority shareholders. Right?
Correct.
The Reed Court of Appeals concluded with minimal explanation. That the plaintiff alleged a primary duty to the corporation, not an injury primarily to the plaintiff as an individual. That case seems to go against you.
Absolutely.
In Jorgensen 2, authored by Judge Robinsack, Reed is not cited at all. And the Jorgensen 2 opinion set forth the rule that an injury due to a director's action is primarily an injury to an individual shareholder if it affects a shareholder's rights in a manner distinct from the effect upon other shareholders. Is that a correct statement?
Correct.
All right. That sounds like it's for you.
Absolutely.
I didn't want to be unfair in my statement of the cases. All right. Then I go to Jorgensen 1, okay? Which involved the same people as in Jorgensen 2. The plaintiffs in Jorgensen were shareholders and directors of a corporation holding a third of the stock. That's a minority. They sued the corporation's other four shareholder directors who collectively held that the majority, two-thirds, the corporation's shareholders. And they claimed the breach of fiduciary duty. The Jorgensen 1 plaintiffs made the following pertinent allegations, and I'm just going to read the ones that the Court of Appeals went after, okay? All four defendant director shareholders paid fees to themselves, which were in fact dividends. Sound familiar?
Very.
Two of the defendant director shareholders conspired to remove the plaintiffs from their positions as officers and directors of the corporation. Jorgensen 1 Court of Appeals concluded that the latter two allegations, they're the ones I just read to you, constituted allegations of an injury primarily to the plaintiffs as individuals, alleging that the defendant majority shareholders and directors breached by fiduciary duty caused injury to plaintiffs by paying themselves fees and bonuses, which are in fact dividends to the detriment of plaintiffs, and that the defendants have caused injury by removing the plaintiffs from the board of directors and controlling the corporation as if they were sole shareholders with no obligations. How do you reconcile Jorgensen 1 and Jorgensen 2 along with Reed?
To start with, Your Honor, I can't reconcile Reed with Jorgensen 2, and I think that's one of the reasons this case belongs right here before this court, because shareholders and owners, majority and minority alike, deserve an answer to the very fundamental question of whether what the majority shareholder did is appropriate or not.
And Jorgensen 2 or 1 could not overturn Reed. That's not in the authority of the Court of Appeals.
That's okay. All right. In Jorgensen 1, however, it's notable that the issues were decided after summary judgment, and during the court's discussion of the claims relating to alleged corporate waste or misuse of corporate assets, it was noted that Dwayne Jorgensen, the plaintiff, could not come up with any proof to show that there was any misuse. And so that allegation seems to have fallen by the wayside by the time you get to Jorgensen 2, and the Court of Appeals makes what we consider to be the correct holding that where action by a majority shareholder results in an imbalance where the majority gets and the minority does not, that majority has, number one, violated their direct fiduciary duty owed to the minority not to place its interests above the minority's interests, and number two, has violated that in a manner that allows the minority shareholder to bring a direct claim to enforce its rights. It cannot be disputed here, because we're here on a motion to dismiss, where all of our allegations must be accepted as true, and all inferences must be made in favor of stating a claim, that the Smith Group placed its interest directly ahead of Mr. Notes's. In very blunt terms, the Smith Group said, the plastics operations are good enough for us, but they're not good enough for Mr. Notes. They did this not for any noble purpose, but they did it for the purpose of retaliating against Mr. Notes for rejecting their lowball offers to buy his stock. And they did it for the purpose of sending a message to him.
Does it matter, Counselor? Does it really matter why they did it?
I think it does.
You think so? You think that if they had the best of intentions because it was better for the corporation to proceed forward without your client, that that saves them from a claim that would be there if they did it because they were annoyed with your client?
I think that goes to the defense. Once the direct claim goes forward, that a company would come forward and say, this was in the best interest of the corporation, and I'll show you why. And they're also going to demonstrate that they had pure motives. In a case here where they don't have pure motives, where they're doing this because they want the plastics, and they want to drive him out, and they want to send him a message that he needs to take their lowball offer, I don't think that defense is going to have any weight. Rather, Mr. Notes is going to be able to demonstrate that, in fact, they placed their interests ahead of his. They did so in a manner that violated their fiduciary duty not to place their interests ahead of his, and they did so in a situation that gives him the right to a remedy.
Do you think that Jorgensen is so broadly written that it covers more than just the constructive payment of dividends, which is the facts upon which it rests?
Well, it's an interesting question, Your Honor. I think the case, obviously, at that point was dealing only with the question of the dividends. However, the language used by the court was broad, and it was premised upon the fundamental fiduciary duty to treat minority shareholders as one treats themselves if they're in control. And what the court said is, when there is an unequal benefit conferred by the actions of the majority, that minority's rights are violated and they can enforce them. If in fact the holding is limited to dividends only, and if a majority shareholder, by taking non-cash assets, in this case the entire plastics operations, for themselves, if that doesn't give rise to a direct cause of action, then that fiduciary duty that Mr. Notes has owed directly to him has very little meaning, because what the court is saying is, if the majority harms and violates that duty through the corporation and by taking its assets, then only the corporation can enforce its distinct duty that the majority owes to the corporation. In other words, Mr. Notes no longer has a right that's enforceable. Period.
Well, he has a right to bring a derivative action, and I understand that he tried to do that and didn't get by the litigation committee, but that was never proceeded upon. Because the injury to the corporation, if there was an injury, certainly is something that can be proceeded on in a lawsuit due to the director's actions, which would affect, perhaps, the value of his shares.
2 points, Your Honor. A derivative action is not Mr. Notes' right. That is the corporation's action. He can only bring it
I understand that, but he could bring it as a shareholder if he passed the litigation committee under the current statutes. And he tried to do that.
He did not.
Oh, I misunderstood
Notes,
then.
Mr. Notes has never alleged a derivative claim and has never tried to allege a derivative claim. Mr. Notes did, as evidenced in the special litigation committee report, which isn't a part of the record appropriate to consider for looking at our complaint, but he did send a letter to the company alerting the company that there may well be derivative claims that the company can look into.
Oh, I see. Okay, thank you.
But he never, and in fact, at the end of the very first hearing, Judge Franke explicitly asked Mr. Notes whether he intended to try to allege a derivative claim, and he said no.
Okay. Thank you.
One of the statements in Rose versus Shantz, when the court adopted...
Counsel, yes. I'm not quite understanding what you just said in light of footnote 3 of the Court of Appeals opinion.
Footnote 3 was mistaken, Your Honor. That was a mistake by the Court of Appeals. Mr. Notes has never alleged a derivative claim. One of the points that the court made in Rose...
Ask for correction?
No, we did not.
But it's just a fact.
It's just a fact, but it didn't have enough of an impact on us to warrant a correction from the court. And at that time, we submitted the petition, and this court took it. So hopefully that could be clarified in this court's decision. But it's in the record in the transcript of the first hearing before Judge Franke.
Okay. So that's part of the record that he never filed it. Okay. That's easy to check out. Thank you. you.
Now, the other claim, aside from breach of fiduciary duty that Mr. Notes has alleged, is the shareholder oppression claim. That is a statutory claim that was added to the grounds for seeking judicial dissolution in 1991, and it was added to expand the rights of minority shareholders and to protect the rights of minority shareholders. In essence, prior to that time, minority shareholders could seek dissolution based upon fraud or illegal conduct, and the legislature saw fit to add oppression to that. The circuit court had no problem finding that Mr. Notes' allegations that the Smith Group tried to buy him out for a lowball offer, that they retaliated when he refused by taking plastics and other aspects, that they hid information from him, that they wouldn't disclose pertinent corporate information. Circuit court had no problem finding that that fit the general definition adopted by most courts and adopted by Jorgensen 1, of oppression. While the case was on appeal, the grounds sort of changed, and what the Smith Group did is they essentially went through with the merger. The Smith Group and ATS did a short-form cash-out merger and eliminated Mr. Notes and forced him to turn in his shares. The argument that the Court of Appeals accepted was that by that merger, Mr. Notes lost his standing to pursue his claim for oppression. Where that analysis runs into, I think, a direct legislative roadblock is in Section 180.1106.1d, which is specific to mergers. And what that says couldn't be clearer. It says that when a company decides to go through with the merger, that all claims pending at the time of the merger, quote, may be continued as if the merger did not occur. And that's a policy decision by the legislature. While allowing companies the right to go through with mergers, the legislature has done two things. Number one, as this court recognized in HMOW, the legislature allowed a shareholder who dissents the merger, who is being cashed out, to seek, in a separate proceeding, a fair value determination. But number two, the legislature also said if you're going to merge, you are not going to use that process as a means of getting rid of pending lawsuits. And there's no exception in the statute. It doesn't distinguish between common law claims, statutory claims, creditor claims, shareholder claims. All claims that are pending at the time of the merger may be continued as if there were no merger. What the Court of Appeals holding would do, if this court were to allow it to stand, is to provide a perverse incentive for the company when a minority shareholder files a lawsuit alleging oppressive conduct. The majority will, in fact, have a positive incentive to go through the merger and get rid of that minority shareholder. In other words, the incentive will be there to complete the oppression. What that will create on the other side of the ledger is a minority shareholder who's being oppressed, who has a great disincentive to actually trying to enforce his or her rights, because the moment they file an action alleging oppression, they are inviting the company through a merger to get rid of them. So what Mr. Notes is really seeking here, he has very specific rights as a minority shareholder. He had the right to be treated as equals with the Smith Group. He had the right that they would never place their interests ahead of his. And he had the right not to be oppressed and the right to go to court if he was. Mr. Notes is seeking to bring those claims and have those claims heard at the trial court level. On the motion to dismiss, these allegations should get Mr. Notes into court.
As I read the Court of Appeals decision, there's a lot of emphasis on the word primarily. Is this an issue primarily to the complaining shareholder? The complaining shareholder is not going to be complaining unless the corporation is also hurt. I mean, that's a big definition. Isn't that right?
I think in 99%+ of the cases, Your Honor, when a minority shareholder is complaining about something that has been done to them, the company will also have a beef.
So we have to decide what's primarily. And And the fact that they diverted corporate opportunity, the Court of Appeals says that's an injury to trust, though. The harm to Knott's is derivative. All of the shareholders were affected equally. Then it says, albeit, as the circuit court observed, the Smith group benefited because of the diversion. So all the shareholders weren't treated equally.
That's precisely our point, Your Honor.
Is that where your complaint about the Court of Appeals comes in? Essentially, I mean, I have real problems with that sentence.
That is the critical point of the Court of Appeals where we believe they erred on the issue of fiduciary duty.
All right. Then they go on to give you a bone. Are you going to take the bone on constructive dividend? Because there, the Smith Group was the beneficiary of that expenditure. What do you think of that argument of the
Court of Appeals? Well, as we set forth in our brief, Your Honor, and being candid with the court, to be a comprehensible rule, I don't think you can split up our claims into these discrete compartments because we aren't alleging discrete acts. We are alleging a combined and intentional course of conduct done in retaliation for Mr. Noakes refusing to sell and done for the purpose of squeezing him out. As part of that, the company went forward to take plastics for itself, and it did it in a couple-step transaction. The first was, instead of having Trostel continue to expand its plastics operations by buying Dicton, they bought it themselves. As part of that process, they used Trostel funds to complete the due diligence and then had their directors and officers that they controlled say, nope, this isn't good enough for Trostel or Mr. Noakes, and then step into their other shoes, put on their other hats, and say, yes, we want to acquire this company on behalf of the Everett Smith Group. And we don't think that those can be compartmentalized, but that the actual combined and intentional course of conduct gives rise to a direct claim, or it doesn't.
Question, and that is, what are other states doing in these kinds of claims?
Well, what you find, Your Honor, and I think our brief tried to outline it, a lot of states are coming around to the view that this court expressed back in 1903, that where those in control of a corporation manage its property in such a fashion to give one group of shareholders a benefit that the other does not enjoy, that the minority shareholders have a direct claim. And if there's any trend, you know, I hate to rely on trends, but if there's any trend, it has been towards recognizing this principle in the context of closely held corporations, where there are grave dangers and additional dangers to minority shareholders who are trapped, who have no outlet for their shares, who can be abused, where the majority has complete control over all facets of the corporation. And that is where courts have been landing on these issues. And that's where we would like this court to go. Thank you.
Mr. O'Neill, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Thomas L. Schreiner, representing the Everett Smith Group Limited at Paul.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, and may it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
Mr. O'Neill began his argument by saying that the issue here is whether minority shareholders are to have any meaningful rights in the system that has been in place in this state for almost 40 years since the decision of Rose versus Shantz, and since the legislature amended the business corporations law in the late 80s, adopting the recommendations of the Model Business Corporations Act to build a system of corporate governance and of opportunity for challenge and review of actions taken by majority shareholders and directors in that fashion, whether they have any meaningful rights. By doing so, Mr. O'Neill certainly intends to denigrate the process that the legislature has created, which is in its form, that is the creation of a special litigation committee, and the positive command in the statutes, this court noted when it decided Einhorn on the special litigation committee issues, the only instance in which the legislature has said that a corporation can make decisions that require a case to be thrown out of court or not be brought in court in the first place. Mr. O'Neill doesn't like that result. Now, that process of special litigation committee has only been around for about 20 years, but before that time, the courts themselves, this court as long ago as Luther, the cynosure of Mr. O'Neill's delight, has said that there must be a recognition that claims that belong to the corporation have to be pursued by the corporation. A shareholder can bring them to the attention of the corporation, has to do so, and in the old days, only if a shareholder did that and the demand wasn't taken up by the corporation, could the shareholder bring a derivative claim. Now, the company can, if it wishes to, bring in independent directors who, if they conduct a thorough review and a careful review and exercise business judgment, can decide the litigation that the minority shareholder has brought to the attention of the corporation will not be pursued. Now, Mr. O'Neill tells you that he never alleged a derivative claim in this case, and I will take him at his word on what he intended, but I will tell you that Mr. O'Neill's client, and this is in joint appendix at page 98, made a shareholder derivative demand on this corporation. It's a letter, I mean, it says, our client, this shall serve as notice pursuant to Wisconsin statute, section 180.0742, of a demand that ATS take suitable action with regard to several recent and impending actions by the ATS Board of Directors and those under its control. He made a shareholder demand. You read that letter and it reads like the complaint in this case.
No, they say, are they the same? Is that what you're saying, Mr. Stringer?
I'm sorry.
Are they the same? Is that
they
what
are the same.
It's no. If you make a demand, is that the same as filing a derivative
action?
Not.
No,
okay.
But you have to.
So what's your point?
My point is that he initiated a process that the legislature has prescribed for a shareholder who wishes to pursue, the company to pursue, wishes himself to pursue a derivative claim. He has to make demand on the corporation. He did that.
But he didn't follow through.
I'm sorry?
He did not follow through.
He filed a complaint then, after he knew that the Special Litigation Committee had been appointed and was working, and after they'd asked him to cooperate with them and he'd refused. He filed a complaint in court, and he alleged the same conduct in the civil complaint as was alleged in this derivative demand letter. And he said, I'm not pursuing this as a derivative claim. But as Your Honor knows, claims speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The facts in a complaint drive what relief a plaintiff is entitled to. And so we responded to this complaint by when the committee had finished its work and issued its report, because this claim that he originally filed states a derivative claim as a matter of law. In our view,
that's your view.
That is my view, and I think that's supported by the case law. It's supported by all the cases. It's
supported by Luther. Does it support footnote 3?
Please?
Does it support footnote 3 in the
footnote
3
is incorrect in saying, in its first sentence, that they brought a derivative claim. They disclaimed bringing a derivative claim. However, they alleged facts that they had earlier said gave rise to a derivative claim.
So there's a dispute between the parties as to whether or not
there's a dispute
the complaint sets forth a derivative action or sets forth a minority shareholder action, which is primarily designed to protect the minority shareholder. That's the Rose case?
That's the Rose case.
Okay.
And the Rose case, by the way, is thoroughly consistent with Luther. Rose wasn't new law. Rose stated it clearly and succinctly. The Court of Appeals decisions that have followed since then have cited Rose and haven't gone back to Luther. But this distinction, and Your Honor, I reconcile all of these cases, and I reconcile them easily. This distinction, which says, we don't care. I mean, directors, majority shareholders, officers have duties to lots of people coexisting. They have duties to the minority shareholders, yes. They have duties to the corporation. They have duties to the majority shareholders. What the regime that the case law and the legislature and the statutes have imposed is, notwithstanding the fact that those duties to various people may coexist, the claim that can be brought in court, and that's where this primary, what do we mean by primary? That's where this comes from. If the primary harm is to the corporation, then the derivative claim, and Rose says this, and only the derivative claim shall be pursued. Why is that? Because there is a remedy that the legislature has provided, which in fact proves adequate, although it is not a, if the corporation decides to appoint a special litigation committee, it is not a litigation remedy. The legislature, picking up on the long-time hostility of the courts to derivative actions, has, because of their tendency to become strike suits, because this all arises in the context of minority shareholders who are stuck. I agree with that. Minority shareholders who are stuck with a minority share in a corporation that they can't control are often unhappy. They sometimes would like to be bought out. They sometimes figure out that if they can make a nuisance of themselves, threaten litigation and bring litigation, they may in fact be bought out. In fact, that's what happened here. At the end of the day, they were bought out.
Counsel, how does one distinguish between a injury that's primary to the corporation and one that's primary to the individual? And in Jorgensen 1, you have the language primary to the corporation, but in Jorgensen 2, it was considered to be an injury that affects the shareholders' rights in a manner distinct from the effect upon the other shareholders, and it inflicts harm on some shareholders that other shareholders did not suffer. That's defined as an injury primary to the shareholder. And I don't know
what well, all I get the here's what I get. Here's what I did derive out of the cases. Rose, there was a claim, usurpation of corporate opportunity by a controlling shareholder or director, I've forgotten which. And the court says that alleges an injury primarily to the corporation. Now, under Mr. O'Neill's analysis, that also alleges an injury to the minority shareholders there, because under Mr. O'Neill's analysis that they, you know, have this interest in the company, they were injured by that. But the holding is it's the corporation that gets to pursue that claim, not them. Not because they haven't had a duty breach, but because that isn't the remedy that the law allows.
What's the reasoning? I mean, that's a conclusion.
Well, the reasoning is, I think, succinctly, to minimize or avoid litigation and to keep the decision about corporate actions. In this case, shall Albert Crossville Company take this opportunity to buy the Dictum and Mosh Company in 1 year, and in the next year, shall they sell their plastics business to Dictum and Mosh? That's a corporate decision. Now, it might have been a corrupt corporate decision, but it's a corporate decision, and it might also have been a proper corporate decision. And the statute particularly, specifically, contrary to the way of the old common law, allows conflicted decisions. It allows self-dealing with the protections that the statute permits. 180.0831, entitled Director Conflict of Interest, basically says you can sell, in our case, a business. You can take advantage of an opportunity to ATS as the majority shareholder, as directors who are also directors of the majority shareholder. You can do it if you do one of three things. Number one, you can have independent directors approve it. Now, there weren't any independent directors on the board at the time, and the company didn't take that tack. Number two, you can ask the minority shareholders to approve it. These are all in 180.0831. And that is a course that the company chose not to take. It didn't have an obligation. I mean, he alleges that it did. He didn't have an obligation to tell him about that or ask him whether he approved. And the third way, it's okay. This is completely different from common law. This is 180.0831. Sub 2C, if the transaction is fair to the corporation. That's the third alternative. Now, that fairness obviously can be determined by independent directors at the time. It can be determined by independent directors who are brought in, as happened here, when the shareholder derivative demand is made, and look at it with fresh eyes and say, as they said here, yes, you know, we would have done the same thing for the reasons we give. So you can have what is a conflict of interest transaction in a corporation. The legislature permits it if you do one of these things to protect the fairness of the transaction. So
what exactly was done? Independent director approval?
That was a special litigation committee. What happened was three directors who hadn't been directors of the company, in response to the demand that was made, this is all set out in the report, three directors who hadn't been directors of the company, who were independent, were put on the board of directors. They were appointed as a special litigation committee. They hired independent counsel. They hired independent financial advisors. They looked at the whole transaction, and they said, had we been on the board at the time, we would have done the same thing that the board did then. They also said, you know, this was really stupid that you didn't bring independent directors on when you initially did it. And therefore, this is to show this isn't a toothless remedy, they essentially fined the majority shareholder $1.5 million for not having done it that way, and subjected ATS to the costs, $700,000 cost of the Special Litigation Committee. All of this redounded to the benefit of Mr. O'Neill's client as a minority shareholder when the company was liquidated. Likewise,
they got 5% of it, is that it?
0.5% of it, absolutely.
And the majority shareholders got 88%.
Absolutely, because they own 88.9% of the
and
company.
And did the independent group find that the transaction was fair to
they
the corporation?
Did. They did, and the report is in the joint appendix. And that report came in, by the way, I've sort of accused of smuggling this into the case. I think the complaint drives whether or not it states a claim, and I think that the complaint, even though it disclaims, or he did disclaim in court, any effort to bring a derivative claim, states a derivative claim for all these reasons of these cases. And therefore, the court, therefore, in order to bring that issue properly before the court, because at that point the company itself had not been made a defendant, sought leave to intervene in the trial court in order to move to dismiss the claim, as provided in 180.1644, dismiss the claim on the basis that the independent directors had made this determination that it was not in the interest of the corporation to proceed. And that's when we came in and asked the court to dismiss it, and that's when, in response to the court's questions, Mr. Freebird, I think, said, well, we're not pursuing a derivative claim. And the judge said, okay, you're not pursuing a derivative claim.
Counselor, would you please address the argument of opposing counsel that the dissolution can go forward because the claim for dissolution was made prior to the cash-out merger?
Your Honor, that doesn't make any sense to me. Mr. Notes is no longer a shareholder. It doesn't make any sense in the statutory scheme of dissolution that a non-shareholder should be able to dissolve the company.
Well, he cites 180.1106.
Well, 180.1106 says that claims remain, that they survive. And that is, as a general proposition, the case. When you have a merger, if the company has claims, they survive. The company doesn't lose them. If creditors have claims against the company, those claims survive. You don't, you know, evade your bills because you've engaged in a merger. You don't engage your just debts. But what the Court of Appeals said, and I think quite correctly, is that's the general, but the specific is, with respect to a claim to dissolve the company by somebody who's now not a shareholder, it doesn't make any sense if you to allow somebody, your question to him and his answer, what good would it do it? Nothing is correct. The dissolution wouldn't do his client any good. It would cause us an awful lot of trouble, but it wouldn't do his client any good unless he says, well, we don't have to actually dissolve it. We could do something else. But, of course, that's based on derivative claims. I'm sorry, one other point I just want to make before I forget it, and that is that the other statutory provision that I think absolutely trumps his argument under 1106 sub B is 1106 sub F. What it says, we point this out in the brief, the shares, other interests after the merger are converted, in this case into cash, and the former holders of the shares are entitled only to the rights provided in the articles of merger or to their rights under the dissenter's rights provision or otherwise under the laws applicable to each business entity that's party to the merger, which we think means dissenter's rights provisions of other states whose corporations might be party to the merger. So I think the legislature has said fairly clearly claims that shareholders have against the corporation that are derivative claims have to be made in the appraisal proceeding. I do want to tell you how I reconcile these cases, if I may. Rose was a corporation, claimed, the majority shareholders claimed to usurp a corporate opportunity. Reed was a case of mismanagement and self-dealing. Dealing with corporations in which some directors were otherwise affiliated. The Einhorn case, not the part that got here, but in the Court of Appeals, the majority shareholder paid retroactive bonuses of money and stock. Jorgensen dismissed, and Jorgensen won, the claims that were derivative. There were derivative claims made there, too, of waste and mismanagement by the controlling shareholders to the benefit of and to enrich themselves. But there was also this claim, and this is what I think the direct claim is, where there's a distinct right that's individual to the complaining minority shareholder. And in this case, it was, look, we all used to take the profits out of this business in salaries. Now you've kicked us out as employees. We're not getting a salary. The profits are going to two-thirds of the shareholders and not to the other third. That's the direct claim. That's the claim that survives. That's the claim that can be pursued. That claim would survive merger, because that's the claim that is one that is personal to the individual shareholder. It's one that he doesn't share with the corporation. Once the directors have decided that they're going to distribute profits, the corporation doesn't care who they go to. It isn't harmed by an unequal distribution of profits, and that's why it's a direct claim. And even Luther was, it's interesting, I think Mr. O'Neill misstates its facts a bit when he says that it establishes a rule about majority shareholders. Actually, it was a temporary majority of the board of directors that acted in Luther. The majority had control of the corporation, but in some interim period, the minority got control of the board of directors and then sold stock to their side, but not to the majority side, so that they then became the majority. That's the claim that was said to survive. That's a direct claim. That's perfectly consistent with Rose. And
Mr. Schreiner, I don't agree with you that the corporation isn't harmed by a wrongful distribution of profits. It is harmed. If there's a wrongful distribution of profits, it is not as well to do.
I grant. If you take profits, that is, profits that the board of directors have properly decided can be distributed to shareholders that aren't needed in the business, whether you give them to all of the shareholders or to two-thirds of the shareholders only, doesn't have an adverse effect on the corporation if it is correct that there are profits to be distributed. That's my point when I say
disagree.
Okay.
Because they're not supposed to do that. And when they do, they have decreased the assets of the company.
But they would have theoretically at least decreased the assets of the company to exactly the same extent if
theory
they distributed
the
profit.
Theory doesn't work as a practical matter, because if you had sued,
right,
you might have gotten that money back from the shareholders who illegally got it.
But at least I think those are the facts of Jorgensen. I think that is what happened in Jorgensen, that the court took it as correct that it was all right to distribute profits. That's how they'd always done it. They just said you can't do it to only some of the shareholders, and if they do, there's a direct claim. And I agree with that, and I think that's a distinction between primary injury to the corporation. I don't find that to be
the word's primary are fighting words. It means you really can't tell until the court says.
Well, if Your Honor please, and I Justice Gableman had a question I want to answer too, but this really is about clear rules. And we've had clear rules in this state for a long time. And I think that it is easy to reconcile the Court of Appeals decisions with Rose and with the primary injury rule set forth in Rose. It's important that we continue to have clear rules. The legislature has built on the fact that the rules are clear in setting up this special litigation committee process. And why in the world would we want to, and I understand what Mr. O'Neill wants to, because he wants his client to get some money. And by the way, he's gotten money twice. He got his share of the distribution when the Dickton and Mosh company, when the plastics assets were sold, there was a special dividend declared from the proceeds, and those proceeds already went to his client, even before the merger. And he got $13 million when the company was sold. Primary, I think, is used, though, to distinguish. It isn't really fighting words, I don't think, Your Honor. It's to distinguish the effect on the corporation from that on a shareholder who is injured by a reduction in the value of his shares, because it's not direct.
Counsel, there's been a lot of discussion about disparate treatment of various factions of shareholders. And there's been a primary concentration or a focus, it seems to me, on the purported benefit that the shareholders in Trostel, who also comprised the Everett Smith Group, received a disparate benefit by obtaining for the Everett Smith Group the plastics operation, not only of D&M, Dickton & Mosh, but then by subsequently obtaining control of the plastics division, formerly controlled or owned by Trostel. How would you respond to the premise that those shareholders receive a distinct benefit that the entire shareholders did not receive, and so therefore those shareholders, i.e. Mr. Notes, were treated differently?
Your Honor, that would be a problem if the business had been given to them. They bought it. They paid for it. They paid an amount that was determined to be fair. Mr. Notes received his proportionate share because there was a special distribution made.
Was that the $7.2 million?
No, Your Honor, and I apologize for confusing. The $7.2 million is actually Mr. Notes' part as opposed to a trust that benefits him. The number on that is 13, actually, rather than 7.2. The corrected number is in the supplemental appendix. That's the amount that was received in connection with the merger. The number, I don't remember what the number was, but the business that was sold back in 2004 was sold for cash. And the cash was distributed as a dividend to the shareholders at that time, rather than being kept in the business to grow the business, distributed as a dividend. This is another part of how you would ever unwind a corporation that Mr. Notes used to be a shareholder in and isn't anymore, in which, by the way, he's already received the consideration for that transaction that he objects to.
Counselor, in your answer to Justice Gableman, you said that the business was sold and he received part of the purchase. Now, my understanding was the business, the plastics part, was purchased through an upstream, or this other company was purchased through an upstream distribution of dividends, and Mr. Notes received part of that. Then are you saying that when it was purchased, more money went back into the corporation from the purchase, and then he received a part of that as well, or is it just
no,
one?
No, the two times Mr. Notes got money were at the second of the transactions he complains about. The first one was Albert Trostel decided to pass on the opportunity to buy Dickton & Mosh, and that was a Trostel corporate opportunity, not a parent company corporate opportunity, and to allow Everett Smith Group affiliate to buy that business. A year later, that plastics business of Trostel, which actually was in a subsidiary, was sold to Everett Smith Group affiliate's business for cash. And the consideration for that sale, which the Special Litigation Committee later determined was fair, the consideration was distributed as a special dividend, and 5.5% went to Mr. Notes. The second sum of money didn't occur until almost two years ago now, when the cash-out merger occurred. That's the second transaction, the second passage of funds to Mr. Notes. He got 5.5% under, by the way, the HMOW rule, which says no discounts for minority interest, 5.5% of the full enterprise value as determined by an appraiser, and subject to his dissenter's rights, he wants more, and he has a court proceeding in which he can seek more. So he has gotten value out of that transaction directly, and he's gotten value out of what was left of the business when the merger occurred.
Would he have gotten more had Trostel bought the plastics company?
That is not what the independent directors determined later on.
Okay. I have a question for you. And that is, if you were going to write this opinion, Mr. Schreiner, what would you say?
Well, I would say pretty much what Judge Fine said, except for the part where he got it wrong, which Mr. O'Neill now disclaims reliance on, and I never did agree with that. I think he misread that.
Talking about footnote 3?
No, I'm talking about the exception for the due diligence expenses. I agree with Mr. O'Neill, probably the only time today, that that distinction was an invalid distinction. It doesn't make sense under his theory of the case, and it doesn't make sense under my theory of the case, because those due diligence expenses were, in fact, legitimate expenses of the company.
How do you explain the sentence, but that is an injury to trust, or that's the company? Well, that, I'm reading from paragraph 17.
Sorry.
That's an injury to trust, and the resulting harm to Nantz is derivative. All of the shareholders were affected equally. And then he has the sentence, albeit, as the circuit court observed, the Smith Corp group benefited because of the diversion. That means that all shareholders were not treated equally.
No, Your Honor, but this is a fairly fundamental point that I have to emphasize.
But
it was true in Rose. It's been true in all of these cases when a majority shareholder is accused of self-dealing or usurpation of the corporate opportunity. The harm is to the corporation, and there's a benefit to the one who allegedly engages in misconduct on the other end of the transaction. That's why I get back to this point of the importance of 180.0831, which allows self-dealing if it's fair, contrary to the view of the fundamental. You can have a transaction.
Allows self-dealing if it's fair?
Right. It allows self-dealing.
Internally inconsistent.
Well, it allows self-dealing if the transaction is fair. That's what the legislature said.
Okay.
That is, I take it to mean if the consideration paid is fair.
You would expect an opinion from this court that says we really adopt Judge Fine's opinion totally, except
no.
for footnote 3 and except for paragraph 18, I think.
No, I would like an opinion from this court that says that this court set the rule, got it right in Rose versus Shantz, and that the Court of Appeals...
You state the rule.
The rule is that when a claim is made by a minority shareholder, whatever he calls it, or whatever she calls it, where the primary injury asserted to the is to the corporation, it is a derivative claim. And as the court said in Rose, only the derivative claim may be pursued.
Okay, but explain what a primary injury is to the corporation. That's where we get...
That is a wrongdoing, which, however much it may also be a wrongdoing to the minority shareholder, is a wrong to the corporation. And all of the standard things you see in all of these cases are such. Usurpation of a corporate opportunity by an insider. Waste, mismanagement, fraud, embezzlement.
Give me an injury to the a minority shareholder that doesn't constitute an injury to the corporation.
Well, Your Honor, you've already told me you disagree with me on this, but I'm going to say again.
I'm trying to get an example.
An uneven distribution of profits is a great injury. Another one would be a breach of a contract, a contract that the corporation has with somebody who happens to be a shareholder. Another one would be the Luther case. Taking advantage of the temporary occupancy of control of the board of directors to unevenly distribute stock, violating preemptive rights of majority shareholders. That's a direct claim.
Chief of Almeida, sure. Counsel, Jorgensen 2 at paragraph 17 and 18 describes this primary issues of primary concern to me. And it states that an injury is primary to a shareholder if it, quote, affects the shareholder's rights in a manner distinct from the effect upon the other shareholders, and if it inflicts harm on some shareholders that other shareholders did not suffer.
Right.
Do you agree with that definition of a primary injury to a shareholder?
I can live with that. I think that's good law, and I think as applied to the facts in Jorgensen, it's absolutely correct that in that situation where the profits of the company had traditionally not been distributed as dividends, but had been distributed as directors' fees and salaries to all of the shareholders equally, and then there was a falling out and the two were no longer in control.
The issue really is how broad is the language. you want to take that language and say it applies only to the facts or similar facts of Jorgensen II. Your opposing counsel says the language is broad and applies beyond those specific
facts. Well, if I may, Your Honor, it's always in contradistinction to where the primary injury is to the corporation. I do not deny that when there's a primary injury to the corporation, there is almost by definition an injury to the shareholder, minority shareholders as well. And it's an injury that benefits the majority shareholder disproportionately. But if it injures the corporation, that's what has traditionally been and should be, unless we're really going to disrupt the law, on which not only the case law of the last 40 years or 105 years in Mr. O'Neill's case, but also the statutes are based. If we don't recognize that basic distinction, because what we will do will be to magnify the amount of litigation that goes on, and we will take claims that the legislature has said really ought to be decided within the corporation by independent directors exercising business judgment, and we'll bring them into court. Plaintiffs have incentive to get claims into court. Legislature doesn't want these kinds of claims in court. It's that simple.
Mr. Schreiner, Mr. O'Neill seemed to indicate that, at least in his view, Wisconsin was out of step with a large part of the country in the protection of minority shareholders. You want to, I think, preserve the status quo. How do you respond?
I don't think he's right. There are 50 different corporation laws in this country, maybe 51, maybe D.C. has one. Every legislature looks at it differently. This is a frequent source of litigation. There will be differences. There is a move afoot. The ALI proposes that we treat close corporations differently from publicly traded corporations, and that we essentially treat minority shareholders in close corporations as if they were partners, and give them the rights of partners. Plaintiff asked for that. The Court of Appeals said no. Our legislature has looked at that. In subchapter 18 of the Business Corporations Law, a corporation can choose to be a statutory close corporation with greater protections for minority shareholders. This isn't one. It's never been one. And so, people see trends where people see trends. I think that the standard embodied in Wisconsin law is not at all, I can only refer you to a number of cases we've cited in our briefs, not at all out of step with the view followed in many other states. We did, after all, adopt the Model Business Corporations Act. And it seems to me, at the end of the day, it's the legislature's decision whether we want to make it easier for minority shareholders to bring intra-corporate disputes into court rather than to relegate them to a process which, as in this case, works perfectly well and remedies the harm to the corporation and then, by that fashion, affords a remedy to the minority shareholder, which is what we've chosen to do and have done for a long time.
If this corporation were going to be a small business corporation treating me as partners, can the minority shareholder do that alone, or you need the majority shareholder?
That has to be a provision in the Articles of Incorporation.
Which would have taken majority shareholders.
So what I'm not insensitive to I've represented minority shareholders. It's not a good thing in some respects to be a minority shareholder. But that's the way the corporation law has been for a long time. You can't have two captains running the ship. And it's a judgment that the legislature and the courts have made. And if there are protections in there that are adequate to, I read these cases, the Rose case and the half dozen since then, I don't think people have been deprived of rights as a result of that. I don't think that the operation of the special litigation committee process is a bad way of doing things. Mr. O'Neill disagrees, but kind of depends on whether you're a plaintiff or a defendant, whether you're representing minority shareholders or majority shareholders, but I think it's ultimately a legislative determination and that the right determination has been made.
Legitimate for the legislature to bar people from coming to court, in effect?
To tell them that their remedy is to invoke make a derivative demand, as Mr. Notes did.
No, to have an independent bar you from going to court whenever the independent group says everything is hunky-dory.
I think that's perfectly legitimate. I think that's a question of how Wisconsin wants to do business. Thank you,
Your Honor. Thank you, Mr. Strang.
I'm sorry. Can I ask one last question? Could you explain to me the relationship of this special litigation committee part of the statute and the dissolution part of the statute?
Mr. O'Neill chides me for trying to bring the two together. He says, well, Schreiner, you're reading something into the dissolution section that isn't there. My argument on that is simply an argument from practicality. And of course, I hope the court never reaches the question of whether he has properly stated a claim for dissolution because he doesn't have standing to pursue it because he's no longer a shareholder. I think the Court of Appeals got that part of it absolutely correct, unanimously, by the way. My argument is it doesn't make any sense, at least in a case like this one, where we're focusing on past acts. I could certainly see a situation in which present or threatened acts, and the dissolution statute makes a distinction among those, past acts that you're complaining about as a basis for dissolution. It seems to me where there is a remedy provided under the Special Litigation Committee process for that, and that channels that litigation out of the courts, it seems to me a little bit crazy, frankly, to say, but if you call it a dissolution claim, you can bring the same claims into court. And by the way, the Court of Appeals said in both Roget, whether normally that's Roget or Reggett, and Jorgensen, I think, that it is Roget and it was Jorgensen, that I've got it here. Roget relies on the same factual allegations to support his contention that he's been oppressed as he does for his claim of breach of fiduciary duty. Quotes Jorgensen to the effect that when oppression is alleged in regard to the operation of a closely held corporation, its factual underpinnings are similar to those of an individual claim of breach of fiduciary duty to a minority shareholder. So I don't think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, maybe it does. Maybe the legislature did that. But I don't think it makes a lot of sense to bar it on the law side, but to allow it on the equity side. But that's my view. I earnestly hope you don't reach the issue. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Schreiner. Mr. O'Neill?
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Schreiner has admitted that his client's decisions, as laid out in the complaint, were corrupt. And well, he should. We're here on a motion to dismiss. And all of our allegations are taken as true, including the fact that those decisions were done brazenly and in bad faith to harm Mr. Notes and retaliate against Mr. Notes. The court asked Mr. Schreiner, well, why then should we bar Mr. Notes from coming to court based on this construct of primary harm versus secondary harm? And his answer was that it minimizes litigation. And that's an answer that calls into question policy. That's a policy determination. And I don't think that policy determination weighs very well against allowing corrupt decisions to go unchecked by minority shareholders who are the subject of those corrupt decisions in a context where doing so extinguishes completely a right that has been kicked around and recognized by this court since 1903.
Counsel, how do we reconcile the policy choice you want us to make with the policy choice the legislature has made in the statutes at issue here?
I'll answer that a couple ways, and the first is the policy choice that the legislature has made is not what Mr. Schreiner alleges it to be. The creation of Section 180.0744 did not suggest a legislative policy against direct actions or that more action should be pushed into the derivative camp. What it said was when there is a derivative claim, this is how it's handled. The statute doesn't say what is or is not derivative. It says it defines derivative claim as one brought on behalf of the corporation. We don't have that here. It's been common law that determines what's direct and what's derivative. And so the reconciliation, I think, when you look at the statutes as a whole, show this. The SLC statute that allows that provision simply says when they are derivative, here's how it happens. If the committee decides it's okay, it doesn't go to court. Then the legislature added oppression to Section 180.1432B in order to provide additional protection to minority shareholders facing just the kind of conduct that Mr. Noakes was facing. And the legislature, in the context of the merger statutes in 180.1106.1d, has decided that a company cannot use a merger to get out from under a pending claim, without exception. And when you look at a whole as the legislative intent reflected by that scheme, what you find is Mr. Noakes is well entitled to have his day in court to challenge that corrupt decision by these defendants.
Well, Mr. O'Neill, I think it's incumbent upon me to point out my recollection of Mr. Schreiner's comment is different. He said it might have been a corrupt decision or it might not have been, but he was saying that in a larger context of whether your client was fairly compensated, which brings me to my question, which is that you told us in response to one of my colleagues' questions that your client did not start the derivative action, but Mr. Schreiner says that the appointment of the Independent Litigation Committee was triggered by a letter written by your client. Is that true?
It is true that the company's election to proceed down the Special Litigation Committee path was instigated by a letter dated August 9, 2005.
From your client? What? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Yes, that was sent by my client.
All right. And if he didn't like the decision of that committee, was there an avenue of appeal available to him for the decision? Now, that study that committee did, I think that the record says it cost $700,000. Is that true?
I really don't know, Your Honor. I know that the letter suggests that the costs at the point the report was written were around $700,000.
All right, almost $750,000. And if he didn't like the decision of that committee, could he not have pursued some avenue of appeal for relief from that decision?
If Mr. Noakes had decided to pursue a derivative claim, and the committee came in and moved for dismissal based upon the report, Mr. Noakes' avenue under Einhorn versus Kalia would be to challenge the independence of the committee or the propriety of its process under the statute. Since Mr. Noakes did not pursue a derivative claim, there has been no such challenge.
Well, doesn't that assume something? That's one way of looking at it. You've just articulated the standards. Maybe the standards couldn't have been met. That might be another way of looking at it.
Well, we don't know, Your Honor, but we do know that Mr. Noakes has never attempted to pursue a derivative claim, has never conceded the propriety of the litigation committee, but frankly, it's not been an issue because he's pursuing direct claims.
But yet it was his letter which instigated the institution of that committee.
That's correct, although, Your Honor, I think to be fair, Mr. Schreiner only read the portions of the letter that support his argument. The letter also stated at page 2, and this is at, Appendix 9 of the Cross Appeal, but it's page 2 of the letter, which is attached to the report. It says, well, some of the acts listed above give rise to an independent cause of action on behalf of minority shareholders. Many of the claims may be derivative. His letter was expressed with the company. There were direct claims. In the closing part of Mr. Noakes' letter, they demanded that ATS take action where it could because its rights had been violated, but said, of course, individual claims need not await corporate action. In other words, this goes to the fundamental point that the same conduct can give rise to both direct claims and derivative claims, and that is a universally accepted proposition.
Well,
there is no dispute on it.
The Independent Litigation Committee apparently found that there was no basis for the corporation to proceed.
Well, this is an interesting point, again, Your Honor, and the SLC, and we don't concede that it was independent, they just say it themselves. That's not a fact in this case.
Weren't three independent directors appointed?
We don't know if they were independent, Your Honor. That issue has never been litigated. It's not a self-proving fact. They were brought in from the outside, but there is not a whit of information about whether they were independent or not, what their connections were. We just don't know. But what they did not give the kind of pass to the company that Mr. Schreiner contends. Under the statute 180.0831, when Mr. Schreiner says a conflict transaction can be not voidable, he says if it's fair. Well, fair in the context of a conflict transaction doesn't just mean fair price. It means fair price and fair process. And what this Special Litigation Committee found, be it independent or not, is that the process, in fact, was not fair. What they said was we would have employed a different process. And if, in fact, that were to go to trial, we believe we will demonstrate absolutely this was not a fair transaction. In fact, it was corrupt, and it was not fair to Mr. Noakes.
Your red light is on. Mr. Gableman, do you have any further questions?
I do not.
Would you sum up very rapidly, please?
Yes. In conclusion, Your Honor, Wisconsin has long recognized a direct fiduciary duty owed by majority shareholders to minority shareholders not to place their rights above his. Our complaint establishes beyond any doubt that that's exactly what the Smith Group did here. If Mr. Notes is limited to pursuing only a derivative claim, that duty is meaningless. That duty is unenforceable. And what that means in Wisconsin is that misconduct and corrupt conduct will in fact be encouraged and supported by public policy. And with respect to the oppression claim, I don't think the legislature could have been any clearer than they were in 180-1106-1D that you cannot use a merger to defeat pending claims. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, both Mr. O'Neill and Mr. Schreiner, in your excellent arguments today on a question that this court had earlier, namely the rights of shareholders as individuals compared to their rights as in derivative actions. This concludes our argument 06-AP-3156, Knotts versus Everett Smith Group. The court will take a recess for a few moments so that the students may leave if they wish and other students may enter the courtroom. Court's in recess.